One, two, three, four. One, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me.
This just in, Irish eyes are smiling, and Sergio Garcia choked yesterday. And with an insightful take like that, you know you're listening to East Coast Bias. Today is Monday, July 23rd. Hello, everyone. We have a big show today planned for you. Brendan, how are you doing on this great Monday?
Good, Jason. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good, I must say. Lots to get into, and let's jump right into it. The Open Championship, or aka the British Open, provided for a dramatic finish yesterday. Basically, if you were under a rock, Sergio had a 3-stroke lead during the final round and ended up tying with Patrick Harrington from Ireland, and then lost by one in a playoff with Harrington. Brendan, it was a great day of golf yesterday, and it begins with the question, did Sergio Garcia lose it or did Harrington win it?
I would have to think that Harrington won it. Both of these guys played particularly bad on the 17th and 18th holes. So it's not as if Harrington really came out of nowhere. At the start of the day, he was tied for third, and of course Sergio was first coming into today. So I don't think Sergio lost it. I think Harrington just played well enough. That inconsistently enough that he was able to win this.
I'm not sure if I can agree with you, because Harrington should have won this easily. There shouldn't have been a playoff. He was up one going on to 18, and he double bogeys it, and that was when Harrington was at 9 under, Sergio was at 8 under through 16 for Sergio. Harrington double bogeys 18, falls to 7 under, stroke behind Sergio. And then, yes, Sergio screwed that up by missing a par putt on 18 to send it to the playoff. But even that was the one case. And then even on the last hole again, almost played it too conservatively and squandered the lead that he had on pretty much only the first hole. The first hole of the playoff, he gained 2-stroke. Advantage with a birdie and a Sergio bogey. So I'm not sure if I can give Harrington complete credit. I'm glad he breaks through and wins his first major. Excuse me. I was combining Sergio and major there. but I think it was more Sergio losing it.
Well, I mean, the 18th hole, it's a tough hole. I mean, that's evident. And I mean,
look at Vandeveld.
Right, exactly. I mean, that famous collapse in 99. It's that 18th hole is, you know, for lack of a better word, tough. Really, really tough. So I didn't really think it was that unusual that both of those guys had trouble in that hole, especially Harrington, who threw it into the drink, much like who you just mentioned, Develde. And then Garcia hit into that. I mean, I don't even know if you want to call that a bunker. I would just call it a very, really big hole. And that was a killer for him, of course. And I think that gets back to what I was saying, where it was just both of those guys were on a tough hole, and both of them played it as well as they could, and it was still very exciting. And I think that the fact that it even went to a playoff just means that these guys were evenly matched, and that I don't see it as Sergio, like I said, losing it. I think Harrington won it, and won it because he was the better golfer that day.
In my case for Sergio losing it is, it was the easiest scoring day at the British Open all week. And case in point, Garcia shoots a 73 on an easy scoring day.
Mm-hmm.
Ramiro, I forget his first name.
Andres Ramiro.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. He had 10 birdies yesterday.
Yeah, shot a 67.
And who knows? He could have won it if he didn't bogey and double bogey the last two holes. Or actually, double bogey 17 and bogeyed 18.
Yeah, and Australian Richard Green, we're talking about that the fourth day being one of the easiest. he shot a 64 when, for the first 3 days, hadn't shot under a 70. So you can see that like you said, that for the fourth day yesterday on Sunday was one of the easiest. But I'm going to go back and say that Harrington, of course, won this. Like I said, Harrington started third. Sergio started first. It was just who was the better man.
Six strokes down at the start of the round for Harrington to win it. So I give him the credit there.
Right.
And I think we can both agree that in the larger picture, this was great for golf and it was great for the sports world.
Some people will disagree with you and say that it wasn't fun because Tiger Woods wasn't even really in the mix. Do you really agree with that sentiment? Do you think that people need to have Tiger in there to enjoy golf?
How does Tiger usually win, Brendan? It's not with a come from behind.
Yeah, we know that.
A intense down to the wire. You know, because Tiger, if he has the lead, he's unstoppable. He has that mental toughness that I don't think, you know, he's going to give it up. And that's what you see when these guys, you know, I was thinking about it with Garcia. You try sleeping Saturday night. You're leading. Did he lead every day? Did he have the lead
Thursday, Friday, and Saturday? From what I can see, I believe he did.
You know, if you put yourself in Sergio's shoes, where Saturday night unless you're Tiger Woods, it's got to eat away.
Right, and the thing is that with Sergio, it's funny that he's just such. It's sad because when he made his majors debut, it was here on the same course in the Open Championship, and he shot an 89 and an 83 and missed the cut. So this would have been a great story for him to win this after shooting that horribly the last time that he was here at this golf course. I feel for him, but I am happy that a fellow Irishman like myself and a fellow Irishman like Harrington won it. It's only the second time that an Irishman has won the British Open, and the first time in a long time.
1947.
Yeah, and the first time in a long time that a European has won it. I had commented that out of the last 9 Open Championships, only 2 Europeans had won it. Nick Faldo and I can't remember the other one, but only 2 Europeans had won the Open Championship in the last 9 years. So it's quite an accomplishment for the European players to finally break through and get a championship here.
First Irish winner since 1947 with Fred Daly.
Okay.
And, you know, it was great for golf. That would be my final point on that.
Yeah, it was a very nice weekend, and it was fun to watch for me. I kind of feel bad for people that weren't able to enjoy it because no one was there that, you know, really high name like Singh or Woods. But, you know, it was a very fun round of golf, and I very much enjoyed watching it. But let's get into something a little less cheery. It was noted on Friday, and this is like a nuclear bomb exploding in the NBA. Veteran referee Tim Donahue was indicted by, and we have said that probably more often than not this last summer.
Yeah, really.
With Mike Vick and, you know, the rest with Pac-Man and everything, and this time it involves sports betting. Apparently, Tim Donahue was using his stature as an NBA referee to quote unquote fix games, and because he was in with the low level mobsters for money, and the way that he was supposedly making his money back was by fixing games, and that wasn't any more evident than in Game 3 of the Suns and the Spurs series, which if you go on YouTube, you can find a video showcasing a compilation of some really questionable calls from that game, and I'll have that link up on the site after we're done with the podcast.
I think the Suns fans, don't watch that if you're a Suns fan, because you've already cried enough, and you really don't want to cry anymore. And
it really validates their suspicions, though. Like, a lot of Suns fans are saying, we got screwed in that game, and now they can say, well, guess what? We actually did get screwed. It wasn't us just
They got screwed because their point guard's named Steve Nash, and this isn't. I mean, until they start playing defense. I mean, I hate to get off topic here, mm-hmm. but the Suns. I mean, the only excuse they can make is that they don't play defense. So I don't want to hear the bull crap about that.
Well, if you were to look at that video, you'll
back on the referee. It's a black eye for the NBA, and it's going to bring up.
I think that's an understatement.
I know, but it's going to bring up a lot of conspiracy, you know.
Oh yeah, the conspiracy theorists are going to come out in droves.
And you don't want to lose the integrity of a very popular game in the United States, and that's what it looks like it's going to do. But I think it's important to keep in mind that right now it's only one man. It's only one guy who did this.
There's news on ESPN News that he could possibly be not the only person. He could possibly name names of other referees and even players. So this could literally blow up the NBA.
I'll try to do both sides of the argument here because I'm kind of down the middle on if how big of a deal this is. I know that's a differing opinion than I think most people out there.
I'd say a majority of people, Jason.
I agree with you, but I wanted to offer a different opinion. First off, to support making this a big deal, I read about a game that he did, Kings Lakers in the Western Conference Championships.
Yes.
Game 7, Lakers got like 19 more free throws in the fourth quarter and put the game away. Last year, he called the most technical fouls of any referee.
That is correct.
And as a fan, this is the other side of it. Two things. Reffing is so subjective. Okay, you got to understand how hard refereeing and umpiring
is.
Yeah,
but not to the point where you're literally questioning whether the guy is competent or not. And that's sometimes last year. And especially in that game 3 that I was talking about between the Spurs and the Suns, you start questioning whether, even before anyone knew about Donahue, people were saying that game had to be fixed. That officiating crew was not just, they just weren't stupid. They were just incompetent. And you couldn't believe that they're actually making those kind of calls.
Like how so, though? What do you mean?
It's like the, if
what,
you,
like the the Amari and Diaw,
no,
where they
no,
come
no, no,
off
no, no,
bench,
it had nothing to do with that. No. These are just regular fouls. I mean, there was an offensive foul on Amari Stoudemire when he was trying to take position down at the low post. There was a charge against Steve Nash. There was a plethora of calls in that game that were just totally blown. And it's not just me and Bill Simmons who said this, and other conspiracy theorists. The guys calling that game 3 were even saying during the game itself that was a blown call, a dumb call, and it should not have been made. So it's not just conspiracy theories. It's these actual announcers of that game saying, what the heck is going on?
I'll accept your opinion on that, but can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Suns or Spurs, who do you like better? Honestly.
Honestly?
Yes.
Suns.
Okay. Case in point, I rest my case. And I called you out on that, but that's how I am too, man. Like if a team is losing, if a team takes a bad foul, but it's one of my favorite teams, yeah, I feel differently about that.
Yeah, but it's not my favorite team. I just rather like them than the Spurs.
I know, but
because
you
the
said
Spurs
you
have
like
won
them
championships.
Better.
Yeah,
and
but that's not
going to
make
opinion,
me that much more biased. I'm a Sixers fan. I could care less whether the Suns got screwed or not. It's just the fact that these announcers and everyone else just thought the officiating was that bad that they even said it during the game. That's not me being biased. Would you consider those guys being biased?
No,
of course you wouldn't.
I understand you. Hopefully you can understand where I'm coming from.
I'm just saying that it's not,
I'm not
just me.
You know, I didn't want to single you out. I'm saying
right.
I think that's how fans are. And I don't want that to be a part of the fan where the fan of the, let's say, the Bucks, just to be pick a random team, you know, will start using this as an excuse of why they're losing.
Right, but
games.
See, here's the thing, though. They may end up doing that, and of course, it's not very noble of them to take that route, but you can't help but say that Donahue, he's going to hang over everything. I mean, every referee,
it is.
Every shaky outcome, I mean, every bad call in a game. I don't think the average fan fully realizes what this is going. This is what kind of effect this is going to have on the game of basketball. Whether or not he's guilty or innocent, it's just the fact that that was even. If he ends up being innocent, the fact that that was even a story is just going to make people come out and say, well, that was a blown call. He's probably paid off or he's shaving points.
It's an interesting, you know, conversation. It really is. And it makes you think, and, you know, you brought up that video. It makes you look back. It makes you want to be a little conspiratorial about stuff. My final point on this is, as a fan, I think we do have to be careful not to rush to judgment. Look, I understand your opinion, Brennan, but I think as much as sometimes...
Before you move on, let's just... One final thing, for me at least. Why do we have to not really... Because the Mike Vick thing, he was also indicted by the federal government. Why do we have to wait this out if Tom Donahue is also indicted by the federal government? Why did you say that we don't want to wait for Michael Vick, but we do want to wait for Tim Donahue?
Because that's three strikes. And this, because it's not, this is becoming more of every referee than just Donahue.
Right, but that's why I think it's a bigger story.
I know, but I think every referee is getting, in the court of public opinion right now, a negative image, and they don't deserve that. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that. Like, honest referees are still going to be working games, but it doesn't matter what happens from this point on, because the referee's collective integrity is always going to come into question, regardless of the fact whether they're highly regarded by even players and coaches. It doesn't matter what their track record's going to be. It's always going to be that guy blew a call, and people are just going to keep going back to Donahue and saying that, you know, he pulled a Donahue.
It's an element of the game. It's an element of the game that can affect it, and it can change it. And, you know, like I was going to say before I was rudely interrupted, as much as I want to go spree well on a ref for sometimes when they blow a call, it's you got to hope and you got to give them the benefit of the doubt that it's subjective and that most of them play fair.
Yes, that's fine and all, but it would be even more interesting once more information comes out, and if he actually starts naming other referees and even players, if that so is the case, then this may be bigger than the Black Sox scandal. I mean, this could end up being the biggest sports betting story of all time in all major sports.
Well, Pete Rose would have something to say about that, but yes. Yeah. anyway, that was a good topic, but we'll have to move on here. A couple weeks ago, we started with the NFC East, and like we have said, we are doing a little segment we like to call Countdown to Kickoff, where each week we'll be previewing every division in the NFL. And this week, it will be the NFC North. The NFC North was vastly different from top to bottom last year. You had a Super Bowl runner-up in the Bears to the annual losers that are best known for their Fire Millen signs, the Detroit Lions. So the North should have many interesting storylines in 2007. And I will start with my fourth-place team in the NFC North. And that will be the Minnesota Vikings. And I think there's so much pressure on the quarterback for NFL teams. I think that's the starting point when you start to analyze teams. And I think that's why I have Minnesota fourth. You know, defensively, they're fine. They were, you know, great stopping the run last year.
Great at stopping the run.
But, you know, they were 6-10 last year. I think mostly the disappointing season can be contributed to having Brad Johnson as your quarterback.
He was pretty much a dinosaur and just, I mean, basically a throwing statue and just couldn't move or anything, and that's much different. Tavarius Jackson, who will be the starting quarterback this year, you know, has legs on him. So he probably should do a little bit better than Brad Johnson, one would expect.
Well, Johnson threw only 9 TDs and 15 INTs, so right. That won't be hard to beat that, hopefully, for Tavares Jackson.
Yeah, Viking
but it'll be,
fans can only hope.
It's always interesting because, you know, you look at what the Vikings did with Culpepper, and it kind of reminds me of Jackson. Kind of guys who were under the radar.
Right.
Culpepper played at Central Florida. Not sure where Jackson played off the top of my head, but it was a small school. And I think they're going out on a limb maybe with this because when you saw him in action last year, he didn't look impressive. I know that was his first couple starts into the league, but that's why prediction-wise I have 5-11 for the Vikings. And it's mainly because of that.
Mainly because
Tavares Jackson. Yes.
But do you think that he's an upgrade? Because if you were to consider him an upgraded quarterback, which he probably is over Brad Johnson, why do you expect them to actually have one less win than they did last year?
Because I don't consider him an upgrade.
You don't?
Brad Johnson. No, because Brad Johnson's been around, man. He's like Jeff Garcia. You know, those veteran guys, they know how to win. They know how to play the game.
Yeah, that's true.
And yeah, Johnson was getting too old, and it was good that he retired.
Right.
But that's the problem you face with bringing in the new guy, a second-year player like Jackson, who's going to have his struggles.
Out of you know, Alcorn every quarterback, State, by the way.
Thank
Another
you.
Another small school.
Alcorn State.
Yes.
And it doesn't help that he doesn't have much help on from his targets, quality receivers.
Yeah.
Troy Williamson's really hasn't lived up to the billing as a first-round pick a couple years ago. I do like the addition of Sidney Rice, the kid from South Carolina, but that's going to take time.
But you can't argue with their front line, though. I mean, Matt Burke, Steve Hutchinson, Bryant McKinney. So Tavares Jackson's definitely going to have room to work with as far as having time in the pocket.
Definitely. And you know, I would say that's the best center, left guard, left tackle combo
right.
in the NFL. That's a pretty mean lineup
yeah,
there.
Is.
And
it
the
is.
Biggest plus for the Vikings, which we should mention, is Chester Taylor, who did have 1,500 total yards last year. And what do you think about Adrian Peterson, Brendan? Do you think it was a good move? Do you like? Are you one of those guys who feels like, okay, you have a proven running back, you're kind of wasting a pick here, or do you think
not really. Only based on the fact that, and we've had this conversation before, that, you know, and it's widely you know, publicized that running backs have a short shelf life. And Chester Taylor is getting older. I don't know how old he is, but he's not exactly young by running back standards. And Adrian Peterson is a monster. As long as that guy can stay healthy, I think this will be an excellent pickup for the Vikings, and it's going to be mainly their bread and butter when it comes to scoring this season. Because, like we said, their wide receiving core is, I mean, subpar at best. So they're really going to have to rely on the running game.
I agree with you. It's the only question with Peterson is the health, and
of course
he's been running over the Big 12 opponents for the last couple of years. So you know he definitely has the talent.
Certainly.
Every team we preview here, I will give a bottom line and prediction. The prediction for the Vikings was a paltry 5-11.
Right.
And the bottom line I'll say is this team will be as good as bad as Tavares Jackson, which we've stated
right.
frequently in this review. And opponents will try to stop Taylor and Peterson and put the pressure on Jackson to beat him. The defense should be a strength again, but until Jackson can prove he can be a starter in the NFL, the losses could pile up for the Vikings. That's why I have 11 losses for the Vikings. Moving on to third, that would be the Green Bay Packers.
The Pack.
Coming off an 8-8 season last year, which is mediocre, not bad for, I would say, the roster they had last year.
Yeah, that is the definition of mediocre. In,
true, but I meant more or less. I meant more or less by the roster.
Oh, okay.
Some of their stats could be misleading if you looked at the season totals from last year.
Uh-huh.
They ended up 9th in total offense and 12th in total defense. And I would think with those type of numbers, you would be thinking of a playoff team.
Right.
Wouldn't you say, Brennan?
I would think so.
Hopefully they can use their 4-game winning streak to end the season as some motivation for the upcoming year. However, I think their two biggest problems are their running game and the inability to stop the run. Mm-hmm. The longtime Packer, Amon Green, is no longer there. He went to the Houston Texans, I believe.
He did.
And they will try to fill that void with Vernon Morency and Brandon Jackson. Do you think those guys can be NFL running backs in this league?
From what I've heard from Brandon Jackson, the guy out of Nebraska, mm-hmm. I mean, from what I've seen, is he's going to be probably the starting running back. I mean, he's certainly going to be challenging Morency for the job. He's a smaller back. A lot of people compare him to a Westbrook type back. Doesn't really have the hands coming out of the backfield yet, but of course he can work on that. But he's very quick. He's elusive. I mean, has a lot of moves, can make people miss. But much like with Westbrook, who did change opinions last year, however, it would be interesting to see if Jackson, if he does indeed get the starting role, how many carries he can really get, and what kind of punishment is he going to be able to take, because he's not playing against college players anymore. These are big, burly men that are coming out to tackle mm-hmm. him now.
It'll be interesting to see how much of the workload he can take.
Right.
And I think, you know, I still, with him being a rookie, I think that's a big problem that the Packers will face next year.
Oh, it certainly will be. But it will be interesting to see how well he plays in his first year.
Since we are talking about the Packers, we should probably mention Brett Favre, who...
Yeah, he's pretty good.
Well...
Was pretty good.
Thank you. 2005, he had a pretty bad year, I would say, for Favre standards. 20 touchdowns, 29 interceptions. But last year, he bounced back and had a...
Mediocre.
I would say above average.
Above 18 and 18, though?
I know, but, you know, for Favre, he's a gunslinger, 3,800
right.
yards.
You're right, yeah.
A respectable.
It is interesting, though, that he almost threw for 4,000 yards and yet still only had accrued 18 touchdowns for
yeah.
the year. Yeah.
And he will, again, have targets such as Donald Driver, Bubba Franks, and the emerging Greg Jennings. So he'll have guys to throw to, which when we were doing Minnesota, that was definitely not the case.
Right.
With Jackson.
Although Donald Driver could be coming in, you know, regressing. Mainly because he's not a deep threat. He's a possession wide. He's a possession receiver. Bubba Franks, I don't even really consider him. I don't even consider him an addition anymore. I mean, this used to be a guy that used to be Favre's favorite end zone target, and now just really hasn't shown up the last couple of years. And I don't know.
Well, I hope Bubba proves you wrong next season.
Packers fans, I'm sure do too, but I honestly don't see much production coming out of him. And Greg Jennings was having a great year until he got injured. So it would be interesting to see how well he does this year, hopefully in a healthy season.
Couple points about the defense. Typically, when you're thinking Green Bay, the defense is the Achilles heel. It's the thing that has stopped them, I think, in the last couple of years of being a competitive team. And maybe that's going to change with A.J. Hawk, who led the team in tackles last year, and the free agent from 2 years ago, Charles Woodson, who they picked up.
Yeah, finally still, came into his own.
Still, well, he's still an elite corner who had 8 interceptions last season. So maybe, you know, they finally have some impact players on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, and Aaron Campman, 15.5 sacks last year. And you when you wrote that article about the Packers, they had met their need to during the draft to stop the run by drafting Tennessee defensive tackle Justin Harrell, mm-hmm. who will probably see media playing time alongside Ryan Pickett. So that defense could be scary. And let's not forget about Nick Barnett, who is also a very good run linebacker. Along with a guy that we know, former Eagle Al Harris, who I'm not going to say is an elite corner, but I mean he's a pretty good number two option.
Yeah, how about upper echelon?
Yeah, that's a good term to use. Yeah, so that defense could
It could be.
Could be and scary, but the offense, like we said, you know, is highly inconsistent.
It's going to come down to Favre. And that kind of leads me to my bottom line with the Packers this season.
Right.
Prediction, last year they were 8-8. I'm going to be close to the vest. I'm saying 8-8 again. I see a lot of mediocrity in this team. But the bottom line with the Packers, with Favre's career accomplishment in his back pocket and an improving defense, like we mentioned, never count out the Packers with number 4 under center. But the problems with the inability of stopping the run and running the ball are so critical, especially in the NFC North, a rough and tough division. These shortcomings will probably keep the Packers in mediocrity. So I will say 8-8. You have any problems with that, Brennan?
No, but I'm pretty certain that the Cheeseheads in Green Bay would have a problem with that.
Okay, well, send your nasty emails to UtahJam at Comcast.net.
Comcast.net.
Yep. Number 2, and I'm going to get a lot of heat for this, and I probably should, is
bold,
the Detroit Lions.
It is. A bold prediction.
I mean, I only have them at 9-7, so I guess I try to cover my tracks a little.
Did you say the Detroit over the underachievers? Is that there? Oh, the Lions. Okay.
That was a good one, Brent.
Thank you. I'm here all
week. Well, anyway. But would you agree that they finally made a good first-round pick with Calvin Johnson?
Jason, I think that he has the highest possibility of becoming an elite player, but, I mean, how many times have we said, oh, Joey Harrington, he's going to be a great quarterback. Oh, Kevin Jones, he's going to be a pretty good running back.
Oh, Charles Rogers.
Oh, Charles Rogers. Oh, those guys look great. They're going to be awesome pros.
Okay.
And Harrington's no longer on the team. Kevin Jones, I think, has rushed for over 1,000 yards once in his career. Mike Williams doesn't care about playing football, and Charles Rogers just doesn't play. I mean, last year he didn't even play one game.
He had drug problems, I think.
Yeah, he did not play one snap last year. So,
but
pretty good picks.
Yeah, except for Calvin Johnson and another guy from Texas, Roy Williams.
Yeah, okay.
And that could be a very, very good 1-2 combo at receiver in the next several years, maybe 10 years.
Yeah, with the exception of the Cardinals starting wide receiving core, I think that Detroit Lions...
Good call.
Just
I agree with you
on the depth chart, just looking at it, is going to be fantastic.
Good call there, Brennan. I like
that.
Thank
you.
One of the problems, I guess you could say, was they did trade away their best player, and I think defensive player, in Dre Bly, their shutdown corner. And in return, they got Tatum Bell and George Foster. They traded them for the Lions. So I think Tatum Bell is important, and I know he's not a great running back, but I think it will help take some of the pressure off Kevin Jones. You know, you addressed his issues in the past.
Yeah, you would
he's
hope
never
that
lived
that would
up
help
to
him.
It. And they've added T.J. Duckett, so maybe that'll be a mean, you know, 1-2-3 combo.
Well, T.J. Duckett was supposed to be something he never really panned out. And the only thing I like the fact that they got George Foster. They obviously need offensive line help.
Proven offensive tackle.
Yeah, only second to Oakland and giving up sacks last year was 63, while Oakland had 72. The problem I have with Tatum Bell is that he fumbles the ball too much. He's too much of a home run threat, and most people would say, well, isn't that good? And that is good to a point where unless he hits that home run, he's striking out on a pretty consistent basis. And I think he reminds me too much of Kevin Jones, and I would think that they wanted to get someone, I don't know, maybe, of course, maybe on draft day they could have gotten someone. There are guys on the board. I'm talking about in later rounds just to get a bigger guy that they can use on third downs. Tatum Bell and Kevin Jones are not
third
downs.
Well, that's what T.J. Duckett's there for, man.
Yeah, but even with T.J. Duckett, I mean, we've chronicled his career ever since he came out of Michigan State, and he just really hasn't lived up to the billing, you know?
Whenever you mention a college, I have to give you credit for that because that is something that a lot of sports fans can't do. So, we're pretty good at that, I would say. But
yeah,
anyway,
I would say so. Go
with
ahead.
The offense, but at least on paper, and I hate saying this.
Yeah, because how many times have we said
that
about the
exactly.
same team?
I feel like I'm getting tired of saying on paper with the Lions. But the offense looks improved. I mean, you mentioned the sacks.
Yeah.
That was a big issue. So they go out and get Foster and Malotulo. I know I'm pronouncing that wrong. But he has been a former Pro Bowler for the Ravens.
Right.
So at least on paper, it looks better.
Yeah. And the thing about Roy Williams is that he was one of Matt Millen's first draft picks who really panned out. And he played really well last year. And I don't know if you mentioned Mike Martz being their offensive coordinator now.
No, I did not.
Oh, but, I mean, if he is going to... I think the biggest free agent move, if you could call it that, for the Lions this season was getting Mike Martz and putting him at offensive coordinator. I think that's going to make... Definitely going to increase their win total this year. I don't know whether I agree with your 9-7 prediction, but...
On PTI, they have the stat boy. And,
right.
I think we need somebody for this because I could be wrong, but I thought this was actually the second year for Mike Martz. I know I'm being pretty specific there. I could be wrong. I'm not sure. Anyway,
Okay.
The success is going to be on the defense. Okay, they have a couple good players over there. Sean Rogers, good at defensive tackle. Corey Redding led the team in sacks last year. Ernie Sims, we should mention him in the good draft pick category. Led the team with 124 sacks last year.
Yeah, really came into his own.
I don't know about trading your best player, best defensive player, though. Because Dre Bly, to me, was hands down their best defensive player. And now you're going to replace him with Fernando Bryan and Travis Fisher, who happened to have zero interceptions last year. So that's going to be the problem, I think. But on offense, they're going to be unstoppable. And the bottom line for the Lions, I was going to say the Dolphins. Bottom line, 9-7, I will say for the
right.
Lions. And if the losing continues, the Millen Man March will get a whole lot bigger.
That certainly is the case. And before we move on to number one, and I think most people know who it's going to be, whether it be from process of elimination or whether they knew it already, Mike Martz did in fact become the offensive coordinator on February 6, 2006, so he has been with them for a year. I was wrong, and I apologize.
You mean 2 years. So,
shut
yes.
up. Go on.
Anyway, so process of elimination, the Chicago Bears are number one. Not a big shock there
no
for
brainer.
Anybody.
No brainer.
Last
there.
Season, 13-3. I think they will be a little down this year. And you see that with NFC champions of the past. Look at the Eagles. They go to the Super Bowl. They win six games. Seattle had a down year after going to the Super Bowl. It kind of just happens. They're still going to be successful in this league. You know, favorites for right now in the NFC would be Eagles, Saints, and Bears. I don't know. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And besides those three, I don't think there's really another team worthy of being called elite in the NFC.
I think there's a couple teams who might fall in that next level. You know, maybe...
Yeah, a following tier, but they're not on the tier with the Saints, the Bears, and the Eagles.
Definitely. And
right.
I think with the offseason they had, the Bears, I think that might be a big test for them, too. Couple big events to keep in mind that happened this offseason. Tommy Harris's comments about McNabb, how he raved about over and over and over and over about how he wanted McNabb as quarterback. So as if Rex's confidence isn't low enough, you know.
Yeah, he has someone on his own team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So with that, Brian Griese, I'm sure, is warming up right now on the sidelines. As I'm sure most Bears fans want him to be. Second, the Briggs holdout still hasn't come to a conclusion.
Yeah.
You know,
it was funny after that Tommy Harris comment, people were Philadelphia fans who for some reason hate Donovan McNabb and think that he sucks. I don't know why that is. We're saying that the Eagles should trade Donovan McNabb straight up for Lance Briggs.
Well.
I know. I'll just let that sink in
for
a second.
I don't think I can respond to that.
No, I don't think I can either.
Speaking of Briggs, the Briggs holdout, like I said.
Yeah.
And who knows what the outcome of that's going to be.
Yeah. He said he would – what was it that he would begin playing in week 10? That's yeah, what was that about?
Yeah.
I think that's when he has to sign. Quote me. I mean, this is when we need Statboy. I believe by week 10, they would have to sign him to a one-year deal or something.
Really?
Or he would just end up playing in order to get his contract, I think, to be eligible to get his contract or something. I'm not really sure, but he said that he would probably end up playing in week 10, much like the Asante Samuel holdout is going on in New England.
And the third would be the releasing of Tank Johnson, highly publicized.
Of course.
That and Pac-Man Jones, pretty much the biggest off-the-field, off-season NFL topics. And, you know, I don't know how great of a player he was, but he was the starting defensive tackle, so.
And that's saying something, especially on a defense like the Bears, which is, you know, that good. So
it definitely is.
He obviously was a valuable asset to that team, and losing him on that front four is going to be pretty big.
A couple changes on the offense to note. Cedric Benson, University of Texas, is filling in for the role left by Thomas Jones, who went to the Jets. And that'll be interesting to see if he...
Let me ask you this. Do you think he's going to be better than Thomas Jones?
Yes.
I knew you were going to say that.
Why am I saying that, Brendan?
You're saying that because you're probably one of the biggest Texas homers of all time.
Thank you. But yeah. Anyway, when he rushes for like 1,300 yards next year,
right.
You will have to write a written apology that will have to be two letters long.
Something similar to the Yankees
long.
Apology that I may end up having to write you.
Yeah, see, and
the
they
difference
can just
between
be back-to-back.
Cedric Benson and Thomas Jones is that Thomas Jones is a multi... He was to the Bears what Brian Westbrook is to the Eagles. He's a running back, and he's a wide receiver. And that's something that Cedric Benson I don't think ever will be.
Well... I'm glad they play the position of running back.
Yeah.
And that usually entitles running. So.
Well, it also entails catching the ball out of the backfield,
if I'm not mistaken.
Cedric
Benson will be a better running back than Thomas Jones ever was. So.
All right, we'll see about that.
And
Chris Sims, that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say. Go on.
Ricky Williams. Much of the important pieces stay the same on offense, and the addition of University of Miami, Greg Olsen, should help Rex Grossman. Big target now, at least he'll have at tight end. And go ahead.
Big target. I mean, they had this guy called Desmond Clark last year. He was pretty.
Yeah, but he's over. He's overrated. He's over the hill.
Over the hill? He's not even 30.
But he's not a star in this league.
Greg
Olsen has star power.
How does Greg Olsen, who was just drafted, hasn't played a down in football yet?
Because he has big play potential. I'm serious.
Okay. Go ahead.
What's longest play Desmond Clark had last year?
I don't know. I'm not a Bears fan. All I know is that Desmond Clark was on my fantasy team, and I know that he did really well last year for me.
All right. Okay. This is what we're going to do.
Uh-huh.
We're going to post a question. Greg Olsen or Desmond Clark, okay?
Okay.
We'll post it on an armchair or something. We'll see who wins that.
Okay.
Anyway, okay. Bottom line, as it's going to be with number 8 at center. Every time the Bears line up with number 8 under center, that's the biggest question they'll face. You know what I mean? Rex Grossman, can they win with him? How far can he take him? So I have a little drop off. I have him 11-5, 13-3 last year. Agree or disagree, Brennan?
11-5 I think is a good prediction for them, considering that I don't think Cedric Benson is going to be as good as you think he's going to be.
Really trying to piss me off.
I do agree that we may disagree on whether Greg Olsen is going to be a star in this league, but
I never said that.
Well, come on, you're like
his big playability, Brennan.
Big playability, which usually entails him being a star, right?
No.
No? Who's got big playability and isn't a star?
Jeremy Shockey
has big playability.
Yeah, but he's not a star.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people in New York thinks he's a star, and a lot of people, he's going to a couple Pro Bowls.
Not lately.
That doesn't make him a star. He went last year.
Are you sure about that?
Positive. I'll put money on it.
Okay.
I would put money on it.
All right, well, that was
we'll post it after the show.
That was the NFC North, and look forward to next Monday where we will be breaking down the NFC South. In
the next
installment.
All right.
Well, we're going in alphabetical order, Brennan. I mean, it's pretty simple here. So the next one will be NFC South.
Okay.
And look forward to that, boys and girls.
Yeah, that's going to be... I hopefully this time me and Jason will actually, you know, co-write these. Most of the time we just kind of write them ourselves, and then afterwards we kind of agree and disagree, much like we did today. But, yeah, thank you, Jason, for doing that NFC North preview. And I, for one, cannot wait until football season. How many days is it from training camp now? It's only a couple days now.
Yeah, it's a couple days.
Is it 5 days, I think? It starts on Friday for some teams.
Steelers are the first ones in, I believe.
I need to get NFL Network.
I got it, so I'm ready.
I hate you. My cable provider down here does not even have it. It's not even an option. I can't even just go to Bright House and ask, can I get NFL Network? They don't even have it.
You're a deprived man.
I know.
Anyway.
I may end up crying. Yeah, anyway, let's move on to our weekly segment, the Weekly Phil. And in today's, we have two topics. We have the Phillies, who their bats have been hot. Adjective that I could use.
How about diabolical?
Diabolical? I like hot a little bit better.
Okay.
Anyway, and then the second one, Bernard Hopkins defends his light heavyweight title against Winky Wright in Las Vegas.
The Executioner!
At Mandalay Bay. But let's start getting into the Phillies.
Yeah, what's your Phillies take? How are you feeling this
Ryan team Howard right? has exploded.
Seen up.
Watch out, Prince Fielder. Ryan Howard is going to take the NL home run crown. The guy is on fire.
In fuego.
He is absolutely crushing the ball. And I wish I lived in Philadelphia so that I could see more of these moonshots that he hits. It's just incredible watching this guy. And his average has been climbing steadily. I think he's almost at 280 now. He has, 27 home runs after the series was over. I mean, Jimmy Rollins is hitting the snot out of the ball. He has 19 home runs, hit his 19th yesterday, and a 9-0 win, in which, yeah, I said 9-0. That entails that a Philadelphia pitcher actually threw a shutout. And that hasn't happened since Lieber threw one this year against the lowly Royals. So that was kind of refreshing.
We are so negative in Philadelphia that I think it is important to bring up the fact when we do good things, and that would be that we took 3 out of 4 from – I know you're high on the Padres, and I'm high on the Padres, you know, right. One of the best teams in the NL. So, I mean, you got to give them credit for that. And the one game we lose, Cole Hamels makes one mistake, and they lose that game. He makes one bad pitch. So, you know, it could have been a sweep.
Yeah, and we beat Jake Peavy, who, I mean, is arguably one of the best pitchers in baseball right now. And it was refreshing to see the Phillies actually beat up on some good pitching, not just some mediocre pitching. And J.D. Durbin, 9 innings pitched, 5 hits, 3 walks, and 3 strikeouts. He pitched excellent yesterday, and I couldn't be happier to see someone on the Phillies actually pitching well an entire game. And it's great because the bullpen finally got a rest.
I'm the kind of guy that believes in, kind of in sports, the law of averages, where maybe somebody has a tremendous first half and it's only fitting, or you know that they can't keep up that pace. You know that they're perform less than what they did.
Right.
So that philosophy I'm trying to picture with their pitching staff. How can it get any worse?
Right.
Yeah. So if we're mediocre in the pitching department the rest of the way, you know, mm-hmm. I'm not counting them out. And when we've talked Phillies before, you know, I went on the record saying right now I don't see it. I don't see a playoff.
Right.
And I'm not going to say that yet, but I could – you know, I could see the possibilities, and because that lineup's just scary.
Yeah, it's, I mean,
you know, everything you need on that lineup they got. You know, you need the base runners. You got Rollins, Victorino. You need a left-hand fast guy who can play the field good. You got Bourne off the bench. You got Dobbs who wants to play. you know, and he'll play wherever.
Yeah, I mean, I could see Dobbs eventually winning that battle at third base.
I would like that.
And it's a shame, too, because we spent all that money on Wes Helms, who's really underachieved. But it's nice to see that we actually have a viable option there at third base. I mean, remember who we had before? I mean, you remember? David.
Well, other than, David Bell.
David Bell, who was an overpriced piece of crap.
God awful, yes.
Yeah. Not even. And the reason that we got him was because of his offensive skills. And, I mean, he was bad on offense and defense. So it's refreshing to have a guy who is actually hitting well at third base. And J.D. Durbin, who I had mentioned through the shutout yesterday, has started his last two games instead of coming out of the bullpen, has performed very well. He was on the 17th against the Dodgers, in which the Phils won 15-3. Six innings pitched, six hits, one earned run, two walks, and three strikeouts. So maybe J.D. Durbin could not. I'm not saying he's going to be an ace or anything. Don't get me wrong, but if he performs well enough, and I'm saying well enough where he has a, you know, kind of high three, like a 3.8, 3.9 ERA, I think that the Phillies would be okay with that, especially since we don't really have a number two starting pitcher right now, and who knows when.
Well, he's not going to be that, but.
Well, you never know. You can be optimistic. I'm sure as heck going to be, because
I'm very
I really
optimistic.
Want to see the Phillies in the playoffs this year.
I'm very optimistic in the fact that Myers and Gordon, or Gordon and Myers, I should say, because I think Gordon would be setting up when Myers gets healthy. That could be a dynamic eighth, ninth inning
Myers makes his rehab start tonight at Single A Clearwater.
And it was great to see Gordon pitch Saturday night. You know, it wasn't in a closer role. It wasn't in a hold situation with the they were up 7-4, so it wasn't like, you know, action-packed and put a lot of pressure on him.
Right.
But it was good to see him, you know, not give up any runs. And, you know, Gordon's a great pitcher, and when he's fully healthy, he's going to be important to this pitching staff.
Yeah, he certainly is.
You know, the back end of it.
And before we move on to Hopkins defending his light heavyweight title, real quick, we're talking about how scary the Phillies lineup is. And for you fans, just think of it this way. If the Phillies had just one, at least one other decent starting pitcher, and we were just middle of the road at pitching, here are how we rank in the NL. Batting average, second, .277.
First
in runs scored.
First
in on-base percentage.
First
in slugging percentage. First in OPS. And third, amazingly enough, in stolen bases in the NL.
I know, man.
If we had one more decent pitcher and a healthy bullpen, how good could the Phillies be?
That's why I'm actually...
I'll pose to you right now.
That's why I think fans...
What would the Phillies be in first right now?
I don't know.
The bullpen
I still
is healthy.
We
have our starting pitching is healthy. Everything is happy, happy hunky dory in Philadelphia land.
Even if Lieber and Garcia were healthy, I can't see that much from them, and that's sad. So I don't know about that, but it would be a different story.
But I guess. But who needs starting pitching when you have a bullpen like that? And because I think the biggest problem that we've been having is that the Phillies, of course, score enough runs. There's no question about that. It's a question of whether if the Phillies starting pitching gives up three or four runs, that usually turns into seven or eight just based on the fact that our bullpen is so atrocious. So I think that we would have won a lot of more games because we would have been able to hold teams in later innings.
I'm glad they leave San Diego on a high note, and, you know, they got to keep the momentum moving forward.
Yeah, Ryan Howard, like I said, is .279 right now, 27 home runs, 81 RBIs, and this is coming from a guy who was on the DL at one point. It would be amazing to think if he was healthy this entire year just how well he would be.
Our other story in the Weekly Phil is about Bernard Hopkins. I would consider myself the golf slash tennis expert of the East Coast Bias, and I will give Brendan the title of the boxing expert of East Coast Bias. So, Brendan, why don't you tell us a little about the light heavyweight world right now?
Bernard Hopkins, 42 years young, I should say.
Thank you. Good.
Was defeated Winky Wright, 12-round unanimous decision. Judges scored at 117 to 111, 116 to 112, and then finally 116 to 112. Bernard Hopkins defends his light heavyweight belt, and I just can't say enough about the guy. And a city that's starving for a title or a championship, this guy is basically it. I mean, since Barbaro, a horse, really, you know, caught everyone's imagination, it's a shame that boxing is just so unpopular with mainstream media now, as far as mainstream sports media goes. I mean, he's the epitome of a champion right now, and it's a shame that no one else really knows about it.
Can we make a promise to never mention Barbaro again?
I'm just saying. Okay.
I am so tired of hearing about freaking Barbaro.
Believe me, I know.
No, but you're right. You're right about Hopkins. And it's funny. I used to live in Audubon, and it's kind of close to where he used to be imprisoned.
Right.
He went to Greater Ford State Penitentiary. And, you know, that was a long time ago. But it's important for people to know that. And it's one of those – I guess you can make comparisons to Rocky with him. Just being – you know, he grew up in a tough background, and, you know, he's overcome a lot.
Yeah, I mean, he was born in Philadelphia, so, I mean, he's born and raised here.
And for 5-6 years he was in prison, so, I mean, that certainly changed his life, and, you know, look what he's accomplished now.
Yeah, I mean, with the exception of those Jermaine Taylor fights, which he got robbed on.
Yes, he did.
I'll just say that right now. He lost his undisputed middleweight title to to the undefeated 26-year-old Jermaine Taylor at the time, and this was in 2005. Everyone, even the HBO boxing and analyst, an unofficial quote-unquote ringside scorer, Howard Letterman called the fight 115-113 in favor of Taylor, but the CompuBox statistics showed that Hopkins outlanded Taylor in total punches and outlanded him by 78-50 in power punches. And I just think that at the time, even if it's a close match, you have to go in favor of the previous title holder. And in that case, it was Hopkins. And
what did
he was unbeaten at that point since 1993. Amazing.
What did the rounds come out as? Was it 7-5?
Letterer called the fight 115 to 113.
But how many? Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, and between the two fights, Hopkins outlanded Taylor 197 to 110 in total power punches. So I don't really, and December 3rd, 2005 fight, Hopkins lost his rematch against Jermaine Taylor by a unanimous and again controversial decision, in which all three judges, and I don't know what fight they were watching, scored the fight 115-113 for Taylor. While Hopkins again outlanded Taylor in total punches and power punches again, almost doubling him in power punches this time, 101 to 60. So it's nice to see Hopkins. He moved up to light heavyweight in order to fight Antonio Tarver, who he completely dominated, and that was June 10th in 2006 when he won the light heavyweight championship. And now, just recently, the story that we're doing today, he outclassed Winky Wright, who hadn't lost since his Fernando Vargas fight in 1999, and he was a previously undisputed middleweight champ. So it's great to see Bernard Hopkins in the limelight again. Great to see him winning again. And apparently he wants to go. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go along. Ahead.
He's called out undefeated, currently undefeated WBO super middleweight champ Joe Calzaghe, also known as the Pride of Wales, wants him to come over to the United States and wants to take his belt away from him. But a lot of boxing analysts are saying that Calzaghe probably isn't going to come over here. And that is probably due to the part that a lot of people haven't seen Bernard Hopkins this hungry and this just this well-conditioned in a long time.
I would say I'm not a huge boxing fan, but even as a more as a observer, you know, if you just look at the facts of being a 42-year-old, you know, doing what you're doing, you got to give him his props. And, you know, I would love to see him take on Calzaghe. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I believe Joe Calzaghe.
You know, if he can do it at 42, why can't he do it in another 6 months?
I know, and it would be great to see him do it. And, I mean, he's the current title holder of the well-respected Ringworld light heavyweight belt. So it would be great to see him, you know, try to add something else to his waist.
And, before, you know, we...
The one last thing before we move on real quick is when he comes out and does the X and has that executioner mask on, there's nothing, for me, there's nothing more exciting than seeing that.
Before we end the show, I would like to, I guess, correct myself. Jeremy Shockey was a Pro Bowler.
Yes! Thank you.
2002, 2003, 2005, and 2006.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
There is your apology, Brennan.
I want and that on, written.
Okay, I will write
out.
It down.
No,
and
not.
On that note, we will wrap up the show. Great show today, Brendan. Remember, keep emailing us. We'll read your questions on the air.
Yeah,
don't
we'll
be shy.
Do that. Yeah. Don't be shy to, you know, send us hate mail as well. We love we haven't gotten a lot of hate mail, but we want to get some more. So
I would love to get a death threat. So
now, I don't know maybe about a death threat, but I wouldn't mind getting some hate mail and showcasing it and making you guys look kind of silly. Or, you know, make us look kind of silly. Anyway, this was East Coast Biased, and I am Brennan Canny.
And I am Jason Mish.
And we will see you guys on Friday. We can't wait.
Peace out, Girl Scout.
And you're working for no one but me.